A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to look at Barney the dinosaur, and not just as a purple guy who sings about cleanup time. He's asking about the encoded messages underneath. The evolutionary tension at the heart of the premise. You've got this giggling dinosaur towering over children, but dinosaurs are extinct. And yet here's Barney, not just alive, but apparently thriving as a child development guru. The question is whether there's something darker encoded in that, whether the show is, in his words, an act of trolling by a deranged writer who takes issue with evolution itself.
I've been waiting for this one. Barney is a fascinating case because it's simultaneously the most surface-level show ever produced and also, somehow, deeply unsettling in ways that are hard to articulate. But I think the prompt gets at something real. There's a tension between what the show says it's doing and what's actually happening on screen.
We have to talk about the giggling.
Oh, we absolutely do. That giggle is doing work. It's not just a character choice, it's a mechanism. Barney communicates through this high-pitched, almost involuntary-sounding giggle that punctuates everything. It's like a verbal tic that replaced actual language in certain moments. And here's the thing, it's not a laugh of genuine amusement most of the time. It's a filler, a buffer, a way to smooth over any cognitive dissonance a child might be experiencing.
It's the audio equivalent of a loading screen. Something unsettling just happened? A logical inconsistency in the plot. The existential implications of a resurrected species becoming a preschool pedagogue. Big giggle, maybe a little dance.
The dance is important too. Barney's physicality is this shuffling, swaying, waddling movement that reads as gentle and non-threatening, but if you actually watch it for more than 30 seconds, it's deeply strange. He's a theropod, or at least he's supposed to be. Theropods were bipedal, often carnivorous, built for predation. And Barney has been softened into this plush, almost gelatinous figure who moves like he's perpetually about to tip over, but never does.
He's been defanged, literally and metaphorically. And that's the first layer of what I think is actually going on here. The show takes the most terrifying class of creatures that ever walked the Earth, creatures that ruled the planet for 160 million years, and reduces them to a cuddly, emotional support animal for toddlers. That's not just softening. That's a statement.
What kind of statement?
That nothing is beyond domestication. That even the apex predator of the Mesozoic can be turned into a feelings coach. It's like if someone made a children's show where the host is a great white shark who just wants to talk about sharing, and the teeth are painted over with glitter.
Okay, but here's where I want to push back a little. Barney isn't a real dinosaur. He's explicitly a creation of imagination. The show's premise is that a stuffed dinosaur comes to life through the power of children's imagination. So the evolutionary argument, the extinction tension, that's not actually in the text of the show. Barney is a toy that becomes real. He's not claiming to be a surviving dinosaur.
That's the surface reading, sure. But the show still chose a dinosaur. They didn't choose a bear or a rabbit or a talking truck. They chose an extinct apex predator. And then they gave it a voice that sounds like honey being poured through a kazoo. That's a choice. Every children's show makes choices about what kind of creature gets to be the authority figure. And those choices encode values.
Let's look at the actual production history, because I think it's instructive. Barney was created in 1987 by Cheryl Leach, a former teacher and mother in Dallas, Texas. The initial concept was built around a bear, but the bear didn't work. They pivoted to a dinosaur because her son was obsessed with dinosaurs at the time. So the choice of a dinosaur was, at least at the origin level, driven by a specific child's interest.
That's even more interesting to me. The bear didn't work. The dinosaur worked.
Part of it is the dinosaur craze of the late 80s and early 90s. You had The Land Before Time in 1988. Jurassic Park was in development. Dinosaurs were having a moment. But I think there's something deeper. A bear is still an animal that exists. A child can go to a zoo and see a bear. A dinosaur is purely in the realm of imagination and reconstruction. There's no living referent. So a dinosaur character is inherently more fantastical, more dependent on the child's willingness to accept a creature they've only seen in books and museums.
That makes the child more complicit in the fiction. If a bear talks, you know it's make-believe because you've seen real bears and they don't talk. But a dinosaur? You've never seen one. You've only seen bones and illustrations. So the talking dinosaur is no more implausible than the dinosaur itself. The child has already done the imaginative work of conjuring the creature. Making it talk and sing is just one more step.
The dinosaur is a blank canvas in a way that a bear isn't, and Barney exploits that. He's not just any dinosaur, he's specifically a Tyrannosaurus rex, or at least that's the closest real-world analog, though the show is deliberately vague about his species. But the body plan, the bipedal stance, the large head, the tail, that's T.
Rex who sings I love you and teaches conflict resolution. The cognitive dissonance is the point. Children don't experience it as dissonance because they don't have the evolutionary fear response wired in yet. But adults watching it? Parents who are trapped in the room while this is on, they feel it. They feel the wrongness of it. And I think that's why Barney generates such visceral reactions from adults.
Barney bashing became a cultural phenomenon in the 90s. People wrote parody songs about killing Barney. And I think what you're describing is exactly right. It's not just that the show is saccharine. It's that the vessel for that saccharine content is a creature that, at a deep evolutionary level, should be terrifying.
The giggling tea. It's like if you took the most frightening thing in the collective human imagination and reframed it as a nurturing figure. That's not just a creative choice. That's a psychological operation.
Let's talk about the giggling more specifically. If you watch episodes of Barney and Friends, you'll notice that Barney's giggle appears in very specific contexts. It often comes right after a child expresses a negative emotion, or when there's a moment of tension, or when the plot requires a transition that doesn't quite make sense. The giggle smooths it over.
It's a reset button. Child says I'm sad because my friend moved away, and then they sing a song about feelings. The giggle is the bridge between the real emotion and the prescribed response. It's almost Pavlovian. Over time, the child learns to associate the giggle with the resolution of negative feelings. The giggle means everything is actually fine.
It's not a real laugh. That's what makes it so effective as a conditioning tool. A real laugh is contingent. Something is funny, so you laugh. Barney's giggle is not contingent on anything. It's an ambient feature of his communication, like punctuation. It doesn't signal that something is funny. It signals that Barney is present and that Barney's emotional state is unchanged. He is always giggling, which means he is always okay, which means the child should always be okay.
The giggle as emotional baseline. That's unsettling when you spell it out, but it's also effective. If you're a parent trying to keep a 3-year-old calm, a character who models perpetual equanimity is useful. The problem is that perpetual equanimity isn't a human emotional state. It's not even a mammalian emotional state. It's a fantasy.
That brings us back to the dinosaur question. Because a dinosaur is not a mammal, a dinosaur is a reptile, or at least a reptile adjacent archosaur. Reptiles don't have the same emotional signaling systems that mammals do. They don't laugh. They don't nurture their young in most cases. So Barney is doing something doubly impossible. He's a dinosaur exhibiting mammalian nurturing behaviors, and he's doing it with an emotional constancy that no actual mammal could sustain.
He's a dinosaur, cosplaying as a mammal cosplaying as a perfect parent. That's 3 layers of unreality. And children absorb all of this without the critical filters that would flag it as strange. They just accept that the purple dinosaur giggles and loves them unconditionally. The show is training them to accept contradictory category information without questioning it.
I want to be careful here because I think there's a risk of overreading. Children's television is full of category violations. A sponge that lives in a pineapple under the sea. A dog that's also a doctor. Category violation is basically the engine of children's entertainment. It's not unique to Barney.
No, but Barney's category violation is specific. It's not just that he's a talking dinosaur. It's that the specific dinosaur they chose carries an evolutionary narrative that the show completely suppresses, and that suppression is what creates the tension. SpongeBob isn't suppressing anything about sponges. Peppa Pig isn't suppressing anything about pigs. Pigs are intelligent and social, so making them into a family sitcom actually tracks. But Barney is suppressing the entire history of theropod dinosaurs. The teeth, the claws, the predatory behavior, the extinction. All of it is buried under purple fur and a giggle.
Wait, Barney isn't furry. He's described as having a soft, plush covering, but it's not explicitly fur. The costume was originally made of a fabric that looked somewhat scaly, but over time it became softer and more plush-like. The evolution of the costume itself is interesting. Early Barney looked slightly more like a dinosaur. Later, Barney became more anthropomorphized and cuddly.
The domestication of the costume mirrors the domestication of the concept. Early Barney still had some dinosaur signifiers. Later, Barney is basically a purple person in a dinosaur-shaped suit. The species identity fades into the background, and what's left is just the color and the giggle.
The color is doing work too. Purple is not a color that appears in nature for large predators. It's a color associated with royalty, with whimsy, with artificiality. A green Barney would read as more dinosaur-like. A brown Barney would read as more animal-like. Purple signals that this is not a creature bound by the rules of natural selection.
Purple is the color of not belonging to any ecosystem. It's the anti-camouflage. And that's actually a smart design choice, because it prevents the child from ever accidentally categorizing Barney as a real animal. He's not a real dinosaur. He's a purple dinosaur. The adjective is doing more work than the noun.
Let me bring in something from the research. Barney was originally a direct-to-video series called Barney and the Backyard Gang, produced in 1987 and 1988. It wasn't until 1992 that PBS picked it up, and it became the phenomenon we remember. The PBS version introduced the school setting, the larger cast of children, the more structured educational content. But both versions have the giggle, both versions have the songs, both versions have the central premise that this dinosaur exists to facilitate emotional and social learning.
The school setting matters because it positions Barney as a paraeducational authority. He's not just a friend, he's a teacher. The dinosaur is teaching your children, and the children in the show treat him with absolute deference. They never question him. They never express fear or skepticism. They accept his authority completely.
That's true of most children's show hosts. Rogers was never questioned. The authority of the host figure is typically absolute in preschool television. So again, I'm not sure Barney is unique in that respect.
Rogers was a human. A gentle, cardigan-wearing human who explicitly modeled kindness and emotional intelligence. The authority made sense because he was an adult, and the viewer was a child. Barney is a dinosaur. His authority doesn't derive from age or experience or expertise. It derives from his constant giggling, his ability to produce songs on demand.
His authority derives from the fact that the children in the show believe in him. And that's actually the show's central magic trick. Barney exists because the children imagine him into existence. The stuffed dinosaur comes to life through imagination. So Barney's authority is a reflection of the children's own belief. He's a self-created authority figure. The children empower him, and then he uses that power to teach them things they apparently already knew since they created him.
That's a closed loop. The children create Barney through imagination. Barney teaches the children. The children learn from Barney. But Barney is just the children's imagination externalized. So the children are essentially teaching themselves with Barney as the mediating figure. It's a feedback loop with a purple dinosaur in the middle.
That feedback loop is emotionally self-reinforcing. The more the children believe, the more real Barney becomes. The more real Barney becomes, the more effectively he teaches. The more effectively he teaches, the more the children believe in the value of the teaching, which reinforces the initial belief. It's a belief engine.
A belief engine powered by a giggle. And here's where I want to loop back to the prompt's question about evolution and trolling. Because if you look at this from a certain angle, the show is doing something genuinely subversive to the concept of natural selection. Dinosaurs went extinct 66 million years ago because they couldn't adapt to a changing environment. The big ones, the theropods like T-Rex, they're gone. That's the evolutionary story.
Non-avian dinosaurs went extinct, Avian dinosaurs survived and became birds, so technically, Barney's closest living relatives are chickens and ostriches.
Which makes the giggle even stranger. Birds don't giggle. But more importantly, Barney represents the return of the non-avian dinosaur, not as a biological reality, but as a cultural one. He's not a de-extinction story in the Jurassic Park sense. He's a de-extinction story in the imagination sense, where children's belief brings them back. And the returned dinosaur isn't a predator, it's a nurturer. The entire evolutionary history of the theropod lineage is rewritten as a prelude to Barney.
That's a stretch, but I'll allow it because it's entertaining. The idea that Barney is a kind of evolutionary revenge fantasy. The dinosaurs didn't really die out, they just went into hiding and re-emerged as preschool educators. It's like if the Neanderthals came back and opened a chain of mindfulness retreats.
And the show never acknowledges the strangeness of this. It never has a moment where a child says, "Wait, dinosaurs are extinct, how are you here?" The question is simply never asked. The extinction is erased. The 66 million years of mammalian dominance is erased. Barney just is, and his existence is treated as unremarkable.
In fairness, the show does occasionally touch on dinosaur facts. There are episodes where they talk about fossils and what dinosaurs ate, but Barney himself is never situated within that factual framework. He's always outside it. He's a dinosaur who teaches about dinosaurs, but he's not subject to dinosaur rules.
He's the exception that proves the extinction. And I think that's where the trolling theory starts to make a certain kind of sense. If you're a writer with a grudge against evolutionary biology, or more likely, a writer who just finds the whole thing absurd and wants to poke at it, creating a character who is a living refutation of extinction. Who teaches children that the scariest predators in Earth's history were actually just misunderstood cuddle machines? That's a pretty effective bit of subversion.
I don't think the actual writers of Barney were trolling anyone. Cheryl Leach has talked about the creation of Barney in very earnest terms. She wanted to make something educational and positive for her son. The dinosaur choice was practical, not philosophical. But I do think there's something interesting about the cultural reception of Barney that maps onto what you're describing. The adults who hated Barney were reacting to something real. They were reacting to the erasure of danger, the erasure of predation, the erasure of extinction. Barney represents a world where nothing is scary and everything is safe, and that world is a lie.
A comforting lie. And that's the tension at the heart of children's entertainment generally. How much comfort is too much? At what point does the safety become suffocating? Barney pushes that boundary further than most, because he's not just a safe character, he's a character whose entire existence is a negation of danger. Dinosaurs were dangerous. Barney is not. Dinosaurs are extinct. Barney is not. The world is unpredictable. Barney's emotional state is not.
There's actually a term in media studies for this, the uncanny valley. It's usually applied to robots and CGI characters that look almost human but not quite, and the almost but not quite quality creates unease. Barney operates in a kind of categorical uncanny valley. He's almost a dinosaur but not quite. He's almost a teacher but not quite. He's almost a friend but not quite. The giggle is the uncanny valley made audible.
The uncanny valley made audible. That's good, because the giggle is the most unsettling part of Barney. It's not quite a laugh. A laugh has a reason. A laugh has a context. The giggle is contextless. It's just there, like a background hum. It's the sound of a creature who is always amused by something you can't see.
It's performative. Barney's giggle is not involuntary, it's a choice. And the choice signals something. It signals that he's in control, that he's managing the emotional temperature of the room, that he's not going to be thrown off by anything a child says or does. It's a power move disguised as a tick.
A power move disguised as a tick. But let's take this seriously for a moment. If you spend hours watching a creature who never experiences negative emotions, who giggles through every interaction, who models a kind of relentless positivity that no real person can sustain, what does that teach you about emotions?
There's actually research on this, not specifically on Barney, but on the effects of children's media that presents overly sanitized emotional landscapes. The concern is that children who consume a lot of this content may develop unrealistic expectations about emotional life, that negative emotions are abnormal, that happiness is the default state, that any deviation from cheerfulness is a problem to be solved. And that can lead to difficulties with emotional regulation later on.
Barney might actually be bad at teaching emotional intelligence, despite that being his entire brand. Because he doesn't model emotional intelligence, he models emotional suppression. He doesn't work through negative feelings. He giggle resets them. The sadness is acknowledged for about 3 seconds. Then the giggle comes, then the song starts, and the feeling is never processed.
To be fair to Barney, he does name emotions. There are episodes about feeling sad, feeling angry, feeling jealous. He gives children vocabulary for their feelings. That's valuable. The problem is that he doesn't demonstrate those feelings himself. He talks about them in the abstract, as things that children might experience, but he never experiences them. He's the emotion teacher who has never felt an emotion.
The emotion teacher who has never felt an emotion. That's the title of the episode right there, because that's exactly the contradiction. Barney's authority to teach emotions comes from he's not drawing on personal experience. He's not modeling vulnerability. He's reciting lessons from a script, punctuated by giggles, and the children are supposed to internalize them.
Yet, anecdotally, many children loved Barney deeply. The show ran for 18 years on PBS. It spawned live tours, movies, merchandise. It was beloved by its target audience. So whatever Barney was doing, it worked for the children who watched it. The question is whether it worked in the way the creators intended, or whether it worked because it tapped into something else entirely.
What do you think it tapped into?
I think it tapped into the desire for a perfectly safe authority figure. A parent who never gets angry, never gets tired, never has their own needs. A teacher who is always available, always cheerful, always ready to play. Barney is the fantasy of the perfect caregiver. And the fact that he's a dinosaur makes that fantasy possible, because a dinosaur has no real-world referent that would complicate the fantasy. You can't compare Barney to your actual dad and find Barney lacking, because your dad is a human and Barney is a purple dinosaur. They're not in the same category.
The dinosaur choice is essential to the fantasy. A human host, like Mr. Rogers, is still recognizably human. He has limits. He has a life outside the show. Barney doesn't age. Barney doesn't have a life outside the show. Barney exists only when the children imagine him, and he exists only to serve their emotional needs. He's a wish-fulfillment creature. And the fact that he's a dinosaur, a creature that actually existed but no longer exists, makes him feel both real and unreal at the same time. He's a ghost and a friend simultaneously.
A ghost and a friend. That's a fascinating way to put it, because extinction is a kind of ghostliness. The dinosaurs are gone, but they're also everywhere. In museums, in books, in the collective imagination, they haunt us. Barney takes that haunting and makes it friendly. He's a benevolent ghost, a ghost who teaches sharing.
Always the giggling.
The giggling ghost of the Mesozoic. I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the show erasing extinction, because I think that's actually the most subversive thing Barney does, not intentionally, but effectively. The show creates a world where extinction is not permanent, where a species that vanished 66 million years ago can come back, not through science or time travel, but through the sheer force of childhood imagination. That's a powerful message. It's also a false one.
It's false, but it's also appealing. The idea that nothing is truly gone, that love and imagination can bring back what was lost, that's a comforting thought. It's the same impulse behind ghost stories and ancestor worship and every religion that promises an afterlife. Barney is doing a secular version of that. He's saying that extinction isn't the end, that the dinosaurs are still here. They're just waiting for you to believe in them.
That's where the prompt's trolling theory starts to feel less like a joke and more like a genuine reading. Because if you're a certain kind of writer, someone who thinks evolutionary biology has been too triumphant, that extinction deserves to be mourned rather than accepted as natural, then creating a character who literally reverses extinction through love is a way of pushing back against that narrative. It's not trolling in the sense of being insincere. It's trolling in the sense of being deliberately provocative.
The dinosaur as a provocation, a walking, giggling argument against the finality of extinction, and the fact that it's aimed at children makes it more powerful, not less. Children don't have the critical frameworks to push back. They just absorb it. A generation of children grew up with the implicit message that dinosaurs aren't really gone, that extinction is reversible, that the scariest creatures in Earth's history are actually your friends. What does that do to a developing understanding of the natural world?
I suspect it does very little, honestly. Children are capable of holding contradictory ideas. They can believe in Barney and also learn about dinosaur extinction in school. The two concepts don't necessarily collide. But I do think there's something interesting about the emotional residue, the feeling that the world is safer than it actually is, that dangerous things can be made safe through love and imagination. That's a lovely sentiment, and it's also not true.
Not true, but useful. That's the whole project of children's entertainment, isn't it? Creating useful fictions that help children navigate a world they're not ready to fully understand. Barney is a useful fiction. He's a dinosaur who loves you, a predator who won't hurt you, an extinct creature who came back just for you. It's not true, but it helps.
Until it doesn't. And I think that's where the adult backlash comes from. Adults who watched Barney as children, or whose children watched Barney, eventually realize that the world is not safe in the way Barney promised, that predators exist. That extinction is permanent. That love doesn't actually bring back the dead, and there's a kind of betrayal in that realization. The giggle starts to sound mocking.
The giggle is a lie you eventually see through. That's the darkest reading yet. Barney is a con artist who convinces you the world is soft, and then the world proves him wrong. And all you're left with is the memory of the giggle and the realization that you were sold a fantasy.
I don't think it's that dark. I think Barney is a product of its time and its genre. It's preschool television. It's designed to be safe and comforting and educational. The fact that it generates these deeper readings is a testament to how rich the material is, not necessarily to any hidden agenda. But I do think the readings are valid. Art means what it does, not just what its creators intended.
What Barney does is create a space where the rules of the natural world are suspended, where a dinosaur can be your best friend, where extinction is just a temporary absence, where a giggle can solve any problem. It's a fantasy space. And fantasies are powerful precisely because they're not true. They show us what we wish were true, and in doing so, they reveal what we fear.
What do you think Barney reveals that we fear?
I think Barney reveals that we fear extinction. Not just dinosaur extinction, our own. The show is aimed at children, but it's made by adults who know they're going to die. And the fantasy of Barney, the creature who came back from extinction, who can't be killed, who exists outside of time and biology, that's a fantasy of immortality, the dinosaur who survived, the dinosaur who will always be there, the dinosaur who loves you forever.
That's moving. Barney is a memento mori in reverse, a reminder of death that has been transformed into a promise of eternal life. The purple dinosaur as a theological figure.
The purple dinosaur as a theological figure. We've definitely gone somewhere now, but I think it holds up. The show's most famous song is, "I love you, you love me." The lyrics are basically a statement of reciprocal, unconditional love that transcends circumstances. It's a love that asks for nothing but love in return. It's a love that doesn't depend on behavior or achievement or worthiness. It's a gape. And it's being sung by a dinosaur.
A dinosaur who, in the evolutionary narrative, should be trying to eat you. But instead, he's offering unconditional love. The predator has become the protector. The threat has become the comfort. It's a complete inversion of the natural order.
That inversion is the show's deepest message. The world is not what you think it is. The things you fear might actually love you. The things that are gone might come back. The rules can be rewritten. It's a profoundly hopeful message, and it's also a profoundly destabilizing one. Because if the rules can be rewritten, then nothing is certain. And children need certainty.
They also need to know that change is possible, that the world can be better than it is, that fear can be overcome. Barney offers that. He's a dinosaur who chose love over predation. That's a story about transformation. And transformation is at the heart of children's literature. The ugly duckling becomes a swan, the beast becomes a prince, the dinosaur becomes a friend.
The dinosaur becomes a friend. And then he giggles about it. Because of course the transformation is absurd. Of course it doesn't make sense. The giggle is Barney's acknowledgement that none of this is real, that it's all a game, that we're playing pretend together. The giggle is the wink to the audience. It says, I know I'm a dinosaur, and dinosaurs are extinct, and this is ridiculous, but we're doing it anyway, and isn't it fun?
I think that's the most generous reading of the giggle. It's not a manipulation, it's an invitation. It's Barney saying, I know this is strange, but come along with me. And children accept that invitation because children are good at accepting strange things. They haven't yet learned that dinosaurs are supposed to be scary. They haven't yet learned that extinction is permanent. They're open to the possibility that a purple dinosaur might appear and teach them songs about cleaning up.
That openness is what the show depends on. It's also what makes the show so baffling to adults. Adults have lost that openness. They know too much. They know about the asteroid impact and the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary and the fossil record. They can't just accept a giggling dinosaur at face value. The knowledge gets in the way.
Which is why Barney is for children and not for adults. The show isn't trying to convince adults of anything. It's not trying to rewrite evolutionary biology. It's just trying to create a space where a child can feel safe and loved for 22 minutes. And if that requires a purple dinosaur who defies the laws of nature, so be it.
The prompt's question still nags at me. Is there an encoded message? Is there something being communicated beneath the surface? And I think the answer is yes, but it's not a message about evolution. It's a message about authority. Barney teaches children to accept authority that presents itself as benevolent, that giggles instead of arguing, that never shows vulnerability or uncertainty. That's a training in a certain kind of compliance. Not obedience through fear, but obedience through love, the most effective kind.
That's a fair point. The authority that loves you is harder to question than the authority that threatens you. If Barney were scary, children would resist him. But Barney is nothing but love and giggles and songs. Resisting him feels like resisting happiness itself, so children learn to go along with whatever the benevolent authority figure says, and that lesson transfers.
It transfers to teachers, to parents, to other adults who present themselves as benevolent. The child learns that the correct response to benevolent authority is acceptance. Just acceptance and participation. Sing the song, do the dance.
I think you're being a little hard on Barney now. Every children's show has an authority figure. Every children's show teaches compliance to some degree. That's part of what children's media does. It socializes children into accepting the structures of the world they live in. Barney is just more explicit about it because the emotional content is so front and center.
But the specificity of Barney, the dinosaur, the giggle, the extinction erasure, makes the compliance training more potent. It's not just listen to the teacher, it's love the teacher, and the teacher loves you, and the teacher is a creature from beyond time who has returned from extinction specifically to be with you. That's a harder bond to break.
And I think that's why the adult backlash was so intense. People felt manipulated by Barney in a way they didn't feel manipulated by other children's shows. The love bombing was too effective, the giggle was too constant, the fantasy was too complete. And when you eventually see through it, you feel foolish for having believed.
The hangover after the Barney binge. You wake up and realize the dinosaur wasn't real, the love was conditional on your participation, and the giggle was just a sound effect. And you're left with the memory of having been happy, and the knowledge that the happiness was manufactured.
Was the happiness real? That's the question. If a child felt loved and safe while watching Barney, does it matter that the love was coming from a fictional dinosaur? The feeling was real, even if the source was not, and maybe that's enough.
Or maybe the feeling was real, but the lesson was wrong. The lesson was that love looks like constant giggling and never being challenged and always being told you're special. And that's not what love looks like. Love is sometimes hard. Love sometimes says no. Love sometimes doesn't giggle.
Barney never says no, that's true. Barney is permissive in a way that real caregivers can't be. He's the fun parent who never has to enforce bedtime, and that's part of the fantasy. But it's also part of the limitation. Barney can't prepare children for the real world because he doesn't live in the real world. He lives in the imagination, where everything is possible and nothing hurts.
The imagination is a dinosaur, a purple one, and teaches you songs, and loves you forever, and never existed except that it did, because you believed in it.
Now we're back to the closed loop, the belief engine. The dinosaur who exists because you imagine him, and who teaches you to keep imagining him so that he can keep existing. It's a self-perpetuating system. And the only way out is to stop believing, to grow up, to leave Barney behind.
Which is what eventually happens. Children age out of Barney. They stop believing. The dinosaur goes back to being extinct. And all that's left is the memory of the giggle, and the vague sense that once, a long time ago, a predator loved you.
That's a beautiful and slightly haunting place to land. The predator who loved you. The dinosaur who came back from extinction just to be your friend. It's a fairy tale. And like all fairy tales, it's not true, but it tells us something true about what we want.
We want the dangerous things to be safe. We want the extinct things to return. We want love to be unconditional and constant and accompanied by a cheerful soundtrack. We want the dinosaur to giggle instead of roar.
For a few years, in the 90s and early 2000s, we got exactly that. A purple dinosaur who giggled and sang and loved us. And then we grew up and realized it was a person in a suit, and the magic faded, and the dinosaur went extinct again. But the memory remains.
The memory and the question. The question the prompt asked. Was any of it real? Was there an encoded message? Was someone trolling us? And I think the answer is, it doesn't matter. The show did what it did. The children who watched it absorbed whatever they absorbed, and now we're left to pick through the bones, like paleontologists, trying to reconstruct what this creature was and what it meant.
The paleontology of children's television. That's a whole podcast series right there.
Don't give Daniel ideas. We've already done Rosie and Jim and the Teletubbies. If we start a paleontology of children's TV series, we'll never escape.
Speaking of which, and now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, a standard hurling ball, or slyatar, used in matches on the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, weighed roughly 110 grams. For comparison, a modern standard slyatar weighs between 110 and 120 grams, meaning the Outer Hebrides variant from 60 years ago sits at the absolute bottom edge of what's regulation today, and would barely pass inspection.
The Hebridean slyatar was a featherweight.
Barely legal hurling. There's a sentence I didn't expect to say today.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumentop, for keeping us on the rails such as they are. If you enjoyed this episode, you can.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.